This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Let's continue our focus on Dylan's five worst years, 1984 to 1988, with a focus talk on the idea that Bob Dylan was struggling during those times. Yes, it's relative, and no, it wasn't all bad, but something was happening. So today we look at what that was and how fans and the press have reacted to and talked about Bob Dylan's work and life in the mid-80s. My guest is Aaron Callahan, who regularly hosts the Dylantons podcast and is the co-author and co-editor of a recently released book called The Politics and Power of Bob Dylan's Live Performances, which looks at Dylan through the lens of his set lists. I talked with Aaron and her co-author Court Carney on a recent episode, and together they'll be editing an upcoming book on Dylan in the 80s. They also co-hosted a panel at the World of Bob Dylan conference in Tulsa last year on Dylan in the 80s that was fun and engaging and very popular. And beyond all that Dylan cred, Aaron is a professor of English at the San Jacinto College in Houston, Texas. So now let's hear our chat about Bob Dylan struggling his way through the mid-80s. All right, welcome, Aaron Callahan. Thanks for volunteering for the task no one wants, talking about Bob Dylan in the 80s.
Well, thanks for having me. And I'm absolutely thrilled to talk about Bob Dylan in the 80s, as you know from my panel. And I thought about my own listening appetites and that I tend to, as you say, we just skip the 80s by and large, except for those few highlights that we like. You know, and then also, I thought about the narratives that are created and the discussion forums or groups that I'm in, probably with the exception of Laura Tenchert's, that they linger in the 60s, mostly pre-motorcycle accident, because that seems to be, in Cohen's theory, the monster that won't die for Dylan, that identity that he has. And then we move on to Blood on the Tracks, skip to Rolling Thunder, quick stop in the gospel era, and we jump right to Time Out of Mind. And that's sort of what you said. And so you said we skip over it as sort of a wasteland, and I think in a bad way, not in a T.S. Eliot kind of way, because that's Desolation Row. And so the few times we have stopped in those other groups, people really hate the 80s. And I was in one where we talked about I, and I think it's a great song. And of course, that's out of the framework that we're talking about today. But I is lovely, and people in that group just were angry that we had to listen to it and talk about it.
That's the thing I want to unpack kind of in this series a little bit. You know, I think the simplest way is to look at it on its own, because it's obvious that if you put it next to the 60s or part of the 70s or, you know, what happened in the late 90s and on, the problem is kind of the dynamic range. In other words, those other things are so high that this gets squashed into this little zone.
Right.
And then you think of it as this narrow zone, and that's fine until you go back. And I've, you know, there's a opening episode of this where I'm kind of telling the story of this time frame, but it, as we know, once you look at it, there's just incredible things there. And the funny thing is that those same people who will dismiss the 80s, you know, love Brownsville Girl, or they love the Tom Petty stuff, or they're, you know, Wilburys fans, or all these things out of the period they think they don't like are there. To me, it's simply a matter of looking at it on its own. And, you know, it's like a graph, you know, from far away, there's not a lot of movement here. You zoom in and all of a sudden, hey, there's a lot of stuff, both a lot of things that make up the line and a lot of, you know, peaks and valleys. There's a pile of songs, you know, that are great. As you proved in Tulsa, there's also a passion. Maybe it's a reflex or people rebelling now against the negative sentiment. I think that covers album that came out, you know, kind of played on it and made it cool again.
But I think that's part of, you know, the wonderful thing about Dylan's studies is that we have people inside and outside of the academy. And as an academic, I was thinking, why do so few people puzzle through this most challenging decade in his career? There's got to be something. And you just proved that to be true. But so it piqued my interest looking at the 80s from the viewpoint of 2022 or 2023, where we can work through how that decade and the work he produces in it fits within his entire canon. And so to do that, you have to examine the existing framework. And so the underlying question for me was, what are the narratives that exist around Dylan in the 1980s and how have they shaped how we approach them? And I think what you just said really speaks to that, because we do have these narratives that are the foundation of, or the framework of how we understand Dylan. Because if you're an obsessive, and again, that's a term you use, which I think is appropriate, whether you are a fan, and there really, I don't think there are many casual Dylan fans. I think you jump right in, or an academic, like whatever, wherever you are on the spectrum, you started out by listening and then something touched you and then you started reading, and the whatever you read, whether it was Rolling Stone or Grail Marcus or any of those folks, Michael Gray, Robert Shelton, I mean, I'm looking at my bookcase and I can just go through the list. They helped create that authoritative voice of how we look at Dylan in the 80s, Paul Williams. And there's not a lot of positive literature or narratives about what goes on in the 80s. And so that has shaped how it had shaped how I looked at Dylan in the 80s. And that also created expectations. And I don't want to seem like I'm being glib. We owe that first generation of Dylan fans, scholars, and critics a debt of gratitude, because they created this conversation that we have, this playground that we all get to, you know, experience now. And they also have the privilege of living through Dylan in real time. And so I think that through his creative process and growth, and there's a lot that, you know, going from 61 to 66, so much change, and it's all great. That I think when you get to, you know, you go through the 70s and you have Blood on the Tracks and Rolling Thunder and even the gospel era, there's some good stuff. But you get to the 80s and you feel that there's this incredible letdown. And so they were reacting to their own expectations. And so it would make sense that they look at Dylan as his creative output waning a little bit. Don't you think?
Yeah, one of the things, as Michael Gray and I've talked through the Song and Dance Man book, has come up a lot, is the difference between the contemporaneous reactions and the retrospective one.
Right.
You know, he told me last week, we were talking about, you know, how Blood on the Tracks was not universally, you know, lauded when it came out. There's that. And then there's the fact that, yeah, if you go through the 60s and the 70s and Rolling Thunder and, you know, whatever you thought about Born Again period, and now you're standing in the middle of, you know, Knocked Out Loaded, or you can go, oh, my reaction today is this is not good. But we now, you know, get to look at it in a different way. And then there's the fact, maybe for Dylan more than anyone, that it takes 5 or 10 or 20 or 30 years to catch up to him, or to, you know, see it in its own light. So yeah, anyway, it's all about reevaluation. You know, the fact that you've looked at it in the big picture and thought about it, you know, and taking somewhat of an academic view on it, and particularly your theory about the arc of his career. And so why don't I let you introduce it, and just let's just go in on how it does sit in the arc and what it means for a guy like Dylan to suddenly be 45 years old, you know, and Prince being at the top of the charts, and having lived through the 30 years, 25 years he lived through before that, all that plays in.
I think there are a few ways. And one of the things that I said to you, and it was actually someone in our 80s panel said it, and it was an articulation of what I was thinking, and I just didn't say it as eloquently. She said that we have to let our geniuses struggle and fail. And I don't think that we've allowed Dylan to do that. And so when we look at this period, it's just seen as a blank failure, because we're not watching him work through whatever he's trying to work through in terms of his own creative process as an artist. And so there are a few ways that I've puzzled through that. And then we can talk about, you know, I can tell you the different ways that I'm considering this as, you know, we're putting the one book to bed and working on the next one, starting to gear up towards it, is that I think that first, he is creating out of contractual obligation. And so now we're looking at this in a very academic way. His art is less a creation. It's always been a product in an industrial capitalist society. But there were, in previous years, he was so focused on the creation process that he wasn't just looking at solely looking at the contractual obligation of it. And so now it's work for him. This is real work. And so, and he says that he's quoted a few times as saying that, and a lot of this is frustration, where he says that it's like working in a coal mine. And so, you know, he's definitely feeling this idea of hard labor. He is looking at it in terms of, you just don't, the recording technology has changed. And so he gripes that it used to be that you just turned on the microphone and you recorded, and what you heard in the room with you is what they captured, you know, at the soundboard. And so he's frustrated with that. So those are two things: that he's frustrated with the fact that it's work that he's doing, like he's forced to be work. And he says, "You're a man is free if he gets up every day and does what he wants to do." We can tell he doesn't necessarily want to be doing this just by his raspy voice. They're uninspired. And so there, that's interesting to me. But another argument that you can make is that when he has those moments, he's able to go back to roots music. And when he's uninspired, whether it's going back to, you know, playing with the band in Woodstock, when he is burned out from the 66 tour after the motorcycle accident, and that seems to reinvigorate him. And then also the gospel period tends to reinvigorate him as well. And so he goes back to this roots music. And when he has his epiphany later on, it's with jazz. And so there's another moment in his career where he feels a connection to music that he feels is sacred, which then goes back to his childhood, listening to those radio stations late at night, that he felt a connection to those, that music that was almost sacred to him. And so he can't seem to find that in 85, 86, when he's, you know, to quote Grail, early on from 1970, like, what is this shit? Like, that's how we feel about it in the 1980, in 85. So those are his frustrations, that the recording process is different. It feels like work to him. He's only doing it for the sake of work. And he can't kind of use roots music at this point as a way to renew his connection to what he's doing. So I think that's kind of how it fits, because we see those frustrations, but then there's a lot of good stuff there, I think. I say my question is, like, what is good in my notes? Obviously Every Grain of Sand is before, but Blind, these are the objectively good things, right? Blind Willie McTell, Series of Dreams, Brownsville Girl, Dark Eyes, the tours, and maybe more so specific shows within the tours. When we were in Tulsa, I was talking to Anne-Marie Mai, and she said that the Santana tour she saw in Copenhagen, and he was awful. He was cranky and grumpy, and he wasn't responding to the crowd. And you know that you've been in shows where he seems grumpier. Even the shows I saw last weekend, the last one, he seemed much grumpier the last night than he did the two nights before. And he just sort of did his thing, and he really didn't talk to us. But the night before, he joked. He made a joke about Tony. So I think that's part of it. But he just, so I think it's more individual performances in that era. And I think when we say, oh, this era is awful, it's not. That's a narrative that we have to break down, because he's got the Heartbreakers tours, like you said, and the Letterman show that people tend to respond to as genius. And so I think people are being overly critical of him based on their expectations, and based on, like you're saying, that high caliber of work that he did. And so he admits in the 1980s, and I think more famously than the 60 Minutes episode with Ed Bradley in 2004, that writing that he did previously was magic and he couldn't do it anymore.
I think it's actually an interesting point about the return to roots, which obviously he's done many times. What we know about the practice sessions for Letterman appearance with the plug was right. That they, you know, he was jamming with those guys for months, as Ray Padgett right. just illustrated. And there's a little less of that in the mid 80s, or at least it, we don't know as much about him driving to that well at that time. You know, this idea about him being contractually obligated, to be honest, I kind of feel like, you know, Bob, like anybody else, and maybe more, does some revisionist history and finds an excuse after the fact when he needs it. Mm-hmm. I always have a hard time when people say that. I mean, it's come up many times in his career, and he says it. Imagine Bob actually saying, I'm going to go do this now because they want me to. It just seems so counter to his, you know, if he wanted to take 3 years off, I kind of feel like he would take 3 years off, even though there probably was a contract.
Right.
And I also feel like these albums, you know, he's trying, he might know, it seems evident, he knows he's not in the same place.
Right.
But you know, as you said, there's a struggle. He is struggling. He's not
succeeding.
Right. The other thing we learn as we get access to the tapes and, you know, obviously a little bit of this, we started to get bootleg theories. You know, there's two or three of these albums that are more, were built over multiple years.
Right.
It's really just going in, recording songs, going in, recording songs. And ultimately, there kind of was enough to cobble together. You know, I mean, Knocked Out Loaded, I think is that way. And Down in the Groove is a little bit that way.
Right.
But again, my guess completely is that he was going in the studio because he wanted to go figure it out. He wanted to do it, even if he knew he was, you know, it wasn't one cohesive project and didn't know already in his head where he wanted to be at the end, where he might have been many before and many after.
No, there isn't. We can argue there isn't a cohesive project. Yes, I think he wants to be in the studio, but I also think that, and there's contemporaneous journalism that says he's, you know, it's for the money. There's a speculation there that he's just doing it because he has to. But there, one thing that would support your argument is, I think, on Knocked Out Loaded, when he has all of those musicians come in and he's playing with, you know, Jerry Garcia, he's all those folks coming in and he's composing with Robert Hunter, like, and even Down in the Groove, it's Down in the Groove he does that, isn't it? Just misspoke. But he, and then he's playing with, he's writing with Sam Shepard, and he's trying to work with other people to compose. And my argument for that, or my maybe, and I could be wrong, and I accept anything that I say about Dylan could be wrong, but he may be trying to create those connections that he felt when he was returning to roots music, when he was playing with the band in Woodstock, that he's trying to find that sort of homosocial connection where he's in a group of men, and there are female backup singers, but they are secondary. But he's working with a group of people that he feels, you know, some sort of companionship or camaraderie with, but it still doesn't quite work for him, as we see. Where it does work is in the impromptu creation of the Wilburys. And we know the story of how that just sort of happens one night. And so that to me seems more organic. And then that's something that tends to work for him because it doesn't feel forced.
That's a set of great examples of him, you know, in their slugging, you know, calling people, bringing things in, trying to find it. I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, to me, his age, right, as we've said before, right, nobody or very few people had been a 43-year-old, 44-year-old guy in that position.
Right.
The world was very different. There's Elvis calls it, Costello calls it the decade music forgot, the 80s. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, there's a lot of people who were in a funk then, maybe because they were all hitting a different age and, you know, they're all interacting with all the changes, right? The outside of their era. They used to be the center of social world. They're all of a sudden not of the age to be the center.
Right.
So that requires a shift of focus and head. They all had come up with, you know, work that was compelling and interesting and aren't the kind of people who want to do it for the 26th year.
Right. So,
you know, a second act, a third act, a fourth act is very hard to find.
The idea that
period of struggle is, I think that's really interesting, and it does sum it up in a way it hasn't been before. And I mean, there's two things. One is, you know, for those of us who care about Dylan or enjoy Dylan, you know, reading the phone book or watching him struggle is perfectly acceptable thing to do.
Right.
And then I also think secondarily that if you look at the challenge Dylan always has is being compared to Dylan.
Right.
So he's said that and others have. And as I listen to this set of albums, you know, two things are true. One, they're not 60s or 90s Dylan necessarily with some songs. I mean, you gave a list. I put Tight Connection in there.
Right.
You know, maybe Someday. Silvio, which, you know, is obviously somewhat of a cover or a co-write. Or it's a cover, purely. You know, I was listening to Empire Burlesque this morning. And, you know, there's some fantastic stuff on there. There's certainly a tinge of 80s production, but that's fine. It was the 80s. And there's some stuff that's less compelling, but it's two things. It's Bob Dylan doing something less compelling, and it never feels un-Dylan-like. And there's a word phrase here or there. There's the way he uses his voice and these other things that we like about him that in the large perspective tend to not get mentioned. And also, I just think on its own, you put him next to, you know, there's the whole world of their additional Bob Dylans or near Bob Dylans kind of guys who, you know, we all like and listen to, but no, never hit the Dylan level.
Right.
I kind of felt like trying to think about this, that to some degree, a bunch of these songs in this period are more like those guys' songs. They're not bad songs. They still have that Dylan component in them, but it's just him not, you know, scoring a 10 out of 10 for a while and banging out some sixes and fours and sevens.
But I think the point that people think that's unacceptable for him is part of the problem.
Totally.
You know, that's maybe the underlying question is like why we're seeing him, you know, puzzle through his own creativity, trying to work within the framework using a synthesizer. One of the major complaints, other than the ones about his voice, is about the overproduction. Another is about the simplicity of the lyrics. And so, you know, we have to wrestle with those now as he's wrestling with them. And I think that, you know, that's a good place. But what you were saying about people not knowing their place, and that was something I said in the 80s, that he's in an unprecedented space where there haven't been elder rock and rollers. And, you know, is he trying to stay relevant, or how does he stay relevant? And he said in 84 to Kurt Loder, it's either your time or it's not your time. And I don't feel like the last few years is really my time. Then 85, he says, I've made all the difference I'm going to. My place is secure, whatever it is. And then he's like, he's not going to worry about doing the next thing or keeping it in step with the times, but he's clearly trying to. But then he says, like, I'm not trying to prove that I'm the top dog. But then he also says, and I think this is probably one of my favorite quotes, it's from Rolling Stone Australia, you're always guided to where you are. And this sounds to me the most Dylan-esque, kind of, you know, a little bit obtuse or abstract, but he says, you're always guided to where you are, but you have a choice to mess it up. And maybe that's what he's doing here. He's kind of messing it up, and we have to allow him to mess it up. Sooner or later, everything that goes around comes around. So yeah, I feel like I've been guided to wherever I am right now, but I don't know whatever it is I'm supposed to be doing, I might have to do something else. So he's you know, he's telling us in real time, like, I'm trying to figure it out. And I feel like people are, because of the expectations that we have for him, because of the narratives created, that they're not as generous to him as they might be if they understood that he's a creative person trying, you know, outside of being a pop culture icon. He's really an artist trying to struggle through a dip in his own creativity and trying to figure out how to work through. So I just, I loved those quotes because that last one, especially, he's telling us, like, I don't know, like, maybe right. I'm supposed to be here. Maybe I'm going to do something else. And it happens that quote occurs the year before, you know, his epiphany in San Rafael, which I think is also narrative creation as well on his part and also the press's part. And it has been, you know, and how a narrative functions in society, it's told and retold, and then it becomes authoritative. And so now we just accept it as, you know, as what happened. But he does use a lot of really interesting sacred language around that. We can talk about that later. But he echoes that, you know, the feeling of wanting to retire in Chronicles. He talks about that he feels disconnected. Yeah, he's telling us in real time, but also in retrospective, he's kind of reanalyzing it as well. I was responding to you saying that he doesn't, about the elder statesmen and like them kind of like the lost moment. Do we want to talk about Silvio? Because I think Silvio is
Let's talk about Silvio.
That's good. My friend Debbie Raps, who is in Israel right now, so we hope she's well, but she hates Silvio. I think she hates it because every time she's at a Dylan show, she wants him to play something else and he'll pull out Silvio. Not every time, but most times he'll pull out Silvio and she's frustrated. I tend to like it though. I think that it's dealing with, you know, again, he's trying to create with someone, with a writing partner. And then I also think that there are some interesting, I know that the Dead rejected it, but there's a connection to some of the imagery. So if we're looking at, this is one of the songs that I'm like, all right, well, if we're looking at themes and images that we see in earlier Dylan to later Dylan, and there's a connection that the 80s is making, even if it is not as successful in terms of composition, you know, complexity of lyrics, that's fine. We can say that. But he, at the end of Hard Rain, he says, instead of standing on the mountain so all souls can see it, in Silvio, he's in the valley and he's letting the echo decide if we were right or wrong, but also this concept of justice. There's also the Western theme, and he's kind of taking on, which I think it's maybe the voice of the cowboy, which is a quintessential American voice. And he does that in earlier works, obviously John Wesley Harding, he does that. And so I think that there's, this song kind of fits as a connective tissue to some of the other stuff that he has. And we have valleys and whatnot going on forward in images of being, you know, like high and low, and speaking your message in the later work, 97 through now. And so I think that it works, but I just like the song. I think it sounds like a train, and I like to run to it. So personally, I like the song.
And I actually think that's got a lot to do with it. I think there's some songs that in concert, you know, Bach has said about his later writing that he would write songs because he needed a certain tone or a certain feel to make the puzzle of a concert work.
Right.
And Silvio, you know, to me is this pounding train, you know, very energetic driving thing that is one feeling that sits in a show and maybe sits between other things. You know, for all those years, I guess it was the 90s sometime when All Along the Watchtower was always song three. Right. There was, I think, maybe a decade almost when, and it was like, and to me, I don't know if this was ever discussed or was known or other people's perception of it. You know, there was a couple kind of warm-up songs. And then I always thought of it as rounding first base. He's going to play that song and then everything is settled. And now we're off to the show.
Right.
And so it wasn't All Along the Watchtower, which in itself, right, is a song and has its own meaning. And I'm sure he likes to play it, but The Blob was serving a function in the show.
Right.
And Silvio is such a, you know, a rave, like this, you know, such a ramp up kind of thing, and the emotion and the voice.
Yes.
The meaning more than the words, you know, which is sort of this pressing on kind of thing.
No, I just think that, you know, some of the lyrics too, like pay for your ticket and don't complain. Like there's like, there's some really good lyrics in it.
Right.
You know, you give up something up for everything you get. It's just like, I mean, and I know the rhymes may be trite and they're over simple. The lyrics are really simple, but still the themes that he's dealing with throughout his career are present in that song. And you're right. His voice is really good. And he's almost playful when he sings it too, I think, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of those things he delivers as kind of a little bit of a joke or an ironic,
you know,
punch. But it's fine. I never thought of it as pump it up, but it's kind of this pump it up song, which is okay. I'm going to go boom, boom, boom right now. And I'm going to come out the back end. And you can't not feel that you just went through that, both him and the audience.
Right.
It's a great example because that you know, Down in the Groove is an album that it's, you know, objectively is the bottom. And I don't know, maybe we need to run a poll on Twitter and see if anyone wants to argue there's something worse than Down in the Groove. You know, and yet, I mean, to me, it's a perfect example of I'll listen to Dylan do that.
Right.
It's perfectly enjoyable. I'm not going to argue it's Blonde on Blonde, but I will put it on, you know, many times a year for sure.
Yeah. It's on my running list. Like I said, I like to run to it because it does pump you up. And so I do think Down in the Groove, it is like it's the nadir of his career, some folks say. And he does, as I said, have great musicians, but it just doesn't coalesce. And here he is trying something that didn't work. And so I think that out of that, we do get born a few good songs. So I do.
Well, it's also, it comes out at the same time as the Wilburys and the Dylan and the Dead. So the idea that it fixes Dylan at this bottom.
Right.
And 88 is live year. 88 is a great live year. It's the birth of the net. And there's somewhat of a difference between the first half of the year and the second half of the year.
Yes.
But I think that also helps to show to confound the timeline. That Down in the Groove comes out, which I don't have the recording dates in front of me. It's after
Down in the Groove comes out on the 19th of May, 88.
Yeah, I was wondering when it was recorded. It was probably earlier that year, late the year before.
Yeah. And then October 88 is when Traveling Wilburys Volume 1 is released.
Mm-hmm.
So 5 months later, all of a sudden he's doing great work and he's still the same person. And so he's creating differently or he's having more fun, but he's starting to work out, you know, whatever it is that has been plaguing him in those really awful years. And I think that it could be, you know, because he says that outside of writing with the Traveling Wilburys, his shared experience with songwriting or writing a song with other songwriters has not been that great. And so clearly he's telling you in 1991 that he really enjoyed that whole process with them. And it goes back to those, you know, the homosocial environment that he seems to thrive in. He loved it with the band. And even though they're on his payroll, so there is an element of capitalism involved, he enjoyed just going over there and, you know, playing in that basement factory as or laboratory, as Grail Marcus calls it, because it allowed him a sense of freedom. And I think he felt that with the Wilburys, that they left their egos aside and they could just kind of have fun together. And it bears out on the albums.
You know, I'm looking at the whole list of things that happened in these years. And I think your point about him reaching out to others for interactions to spur himself, that there probably isn't a 5-year period. You have the Petty stuff, the Dead stuff, mm-hmm. the Wilbury stuff.
Santana. He's not really working, but still.
Yeah, on the tours. I'm saying if you pull this list together of people on the album and people he played with,
right,
it may be the largest number of any period. Mm-hmm. I'll try to play with that a little bit. Which would really say, hey, that was his method. One of the methods of struggle was to not sit alone in a room and try to, you know, write Hard Rain Is Gonna Fall Again, but to, you know, have these interactions. And also for us, meaning in retrospect for the fans looking at this, we love all those interactions, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the other thing I was thinking about this album is, in this period to some degree, we don't want Blonde on Blonde Part 2 or even Infidels Part 2 any more than he does, especially having the catalog and being able to listen to different things at different times.
Right.
So the fact that he was trying different things, working with different producers, taking the sound of the time more, it winds up being good stuff, even if it's not the best stuff.
It's overlooked as, you know, that... You know, Rob Kelly asked that question at the end of Pod Dylan, if you could be on a fly on the wall at any section or any session. No one ever says Down in the Groove, but how cool would that be to be with all of those people? You know, at some point, if you could just be in those sessions, sitting there, like, you know, interacting with all of them or watching them, not even interacting, but watching them interact.
Well, so, also, I think there's a few sessions we don't know about still from this time period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of my favorite things ever is his Solomon Burke cover of Sidewalks, Fences, and Walls.
Yeah.
Which is actually still somewhat of a rarity. I don't think it's been put out on anything. There's 4 versions that circulate, him trying over and over again. And to me, it's in the top 5 all-time Dylan things. It's just beautiful, him singing that song, the way he sings it, what he finds in there. But supposedly that was from one of a series of sessions of this, okay, I'll try this. And he said at one point that, you know, the record company hate, and he often voiced decisions on people I don't think they had.
But right.
He said that, you know, he was recorded a whole bunch of stuff like this and the record companies hated it. So he grumbled and put it away. I mean, it would be great for us to hear it, but it's another indication of him trying, you know, going off in a new direction or going in a studio with a couple guys and picking something he would have never done. You know, the Dylan Stax album would be pretty cool. At least we got this one song.
I think too, like Harry and I talked about this, Harry Hewitt and I talked about this in Tulsa, that we were disappointed with Springtime in New York because we felt that there was a lot missing from it. And that maybe was a missing component, that we wanted more of the good stuff from the 80s in the outtakes that wasn't included. And so hopefully it will come in a future bootleg. We don't know, you know, how many more are coming, but I just think that, yeah, there was a missed opportunity with some of Springtime in New York, that we didn't get everything we could have to then help us recreate or reevaluate this idea of what's going on in the 80s.
Do you think that was a time frame constraint, that they stayed too narrow in time, or do you think they, why do you think that is?
You know, maybe it's the time frame, but maybe it's, you know, ultimately Dylan and Jeff Rosen have to make these decisions, and maybe he just didn't want it out yet. I don't know. I would think that it's something that hopefully in the future we will have greater access to, but it could be time constraint. It could be the period. It could be what they have that's still in the vault that they don't, you know, that they had to put something together. I wish that they had put something different together, the takes that we know that exist, that, you know, and what you're saying too, that it was an observation we made about wanting more of the 80s so we could talk about, you know, we could then support our argument about how great the 80s is.
So tell me a little about the book you're working on, the 80s book. You can talk about the other book too if you want, but
no, I don't want to. I mean, it's a set list book. Well, there's a lot out there on that one, but
okay. So the 80s book is, tell us what you're planning for the 80s book. That's cool in itself.
Well, we're going to do the same kind of thing. Court Carney, you know, Court and I are going to co-edit again, and we're going to send out a call for papers once the set list book drops on November 17th, which is really cool because Live at Budokan does too. And so we have the same release date as Dylan, which is, you know, it's completely, you know,
we'll have to watch the Amazon charts and see who wins that battle.
Oh, as Court says, our book is priced for no one to own. It's $175 because it's an academic book. But we're going to put out a call for papers, and we have some folks who have already claimed things, like Rob Virginio has claimed Blind Willie McTell. And I forget what Grayley Heron has claimed a chapter. We kind of work in a tight group, the core group of us. But just to do what we're doing now is reevaluate the 80s and what you're doing with your podcasts to kind of look at the 80s in different ways. And in any field of study, this was a point I meant to say earlier that maybe I did and I forgot, but you have to reevaluate and challenge those narratives because it moves the conversation forward. And I would hope that the next generation and future generations, so we have in 400 years, people are talking about Dylan like we talk about Shakespeare, that people are questioning our own concepts of the 80s and finding stuff that we didn't even think, you know, that, you know, because they have more access to more work and they're working off of our material. And so we are doing that with the, you know, we have the archives, we have, you know, we have the original authoritative narratives that we can challenge and question, and then we just have our own reactions to the work as well. And so we're going to reevaluate the 80s as maybe not being great, but kind of figuring out how it fits as the connective tissue between what came before and then everything that is still considered great from 97 on. And where do we see those connections? That's what we're going to do.
Well, that's great. Well, maybe somebody can take on a trip to Tulsa and find out what tapes we don't have, you know, mm-hmm. at least tell us the story. Because there's a lot we don't know about. I mean, I haven't opened the old recording sessions book or anything, but I'm pretty sure those are incomplete compared to what we know now.
Right.
That would be interesting. You know, probably an 80s bootleg series is the larger one is probably not coming soon. But it would be interesting to know what's down there.
Yeah, for sure. And there was something I wanted to say, because there's a lot. So even the stuff that we still think is awful or strange, we see him experimenting. I tend to love him dancing in tight connection to my heart in that video. So he's doing videos that are not great, but they're still fantastic because we see him at least attempting something, and maybe it doesn't work for him. And it's the critiques of him selling out or, you know, capitulating to the trends of the 80s, it's the same criticism that people made of him when he plugged in. And so it seems tired to me that, right, maybe he doesn't need to be dancing as a backup singer in tight connection to my heart, but isn't it fun to watch?
I think it's all fantastic. I really don't get, I mean, I guess I should say I, to some degree, started in the 80s, Dylan.
Right.
So it was kind of natural to me, but even now having deeply immersed in all of it.
Right.
I have no negative reaction to any of it. And Ted Connection happens to me to be a highlight, both the early, you know, the original version and then the other version we got later. You know, and I don't think it matters to kind of dissect particularly the reaction, but I don't even know what it is, right? Other than that's not what my guy's supposed to do. Right. And that's why the way I frame all of this, and it's a fake intellectual challenge, is to pretend, you know, that Empire Burlesque was a new album from a new artist who you never heard before. And you did Empire Burlesque, Knocked Out Loaded, you know, Down in the Groove and those live shows, then was gone. And I don't think he's a nothing in history in the least. I mean, we talked about the highlight.
Right.
This is where the entanglement happened. And, you know, maybe it's just laziness, you know, verbal laziness, that it's easier to say it's bad than it is to say it's different. And there's a lot of that. You know, there's Seinfeld's got that greater sucks routine, which, you know, kind of explains society, that there's only two things anything can be. So I don't even think people mean it. I mean, maybe that we're reacting to the larger conversation. It's just that it had to fall one way or another, and it falls that way. I would love to see everyone's, you know, of the hardcore, as I've come to call them, you know, of the serious Dylan fans, what percentage of all their listening is those albums? You know, there was a poll this week on Twitter. Someone did one of these voting for two things and then voting for the winner of the winners and all that. And of course, you know, Blonde on Blonde and
Bracket.
Yeah, brackets. Yeah. So they did that, and you wind up with Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited and Blood on the Tracks. And then I put out a tweet said, okay, they're the best, but who of this group reaches for those albums on the average month versus something else? And, you know, I got a lot of people at least said, yeah, I never reach those three.
Right.
Heard them, I've done them, you know, maybe once a year, maybe if they come, you know, whatever. But
I think what you're saying, though,
Empire Burlesque, Knocked Out Loaded, I listen to a ton.
I think that what you're saying about your entry point to Dylan is kind of the point I made about First Generation, is that they went through the catalog in order. But where later generations are privileged is it's like a buffet. And your entry point is generally where you know, how old you were when you started listening to Dylan. And so yours maybe is the 80s. And for me, I started listening to bootleg. So mine is just all over the place. And so I had to reframe what albums they want, because one of my dear friends, Kerry Winscott, was a Dead bootlegger, but then he just collected all of the Dylan bootlegs and he shared them with me. And so so that was my entry point. But then also the first, I guess, album that I had on my own was Time Out of Mind. And so that was my entry point because of my age. And, you know, so it was a pretty good entry point. But we can then, you know, we tend to privilege where we came into the conversation on Dylan. And I think that's kind of where you are. But you're also exactly, and again, it could be revisionist. We accept that. But in Chronicles, once he has that epiphany, you know, in San Rafael, he realizes that expectations the first generation audience has of him might not fit with where he's going. And he says that he's on the cusp of something new. And he says, I definitely needed a new audience because my audience at the time had more or less grown up on my records and were past the point of accepting me as a new artist. And that was understandable. And so he's far more generous of them than they are of him in the experimentation. Then he says, in many ways, this audience was past its prime and its reflexes were shot. They came to stare and not participate, which is what I think a lot of folks do even now, some of them, when they go to Dylan concerts. There was a couple next to me last weekend who left in the middle of the show, and they left before Truckin', so that's on them. And then he says they came to stare and not participate. That was okay, but this kind of crowd that would have to find me would be the kind of crowd that didn't know what yesterday was. And that's kind of what you said. And he's acknowledging that you have to not have been with Dylan in the early years to accept the 80s as good and to move forward with him. And, you know, maybe it's revisionist. We can accept that because it's in 2003, 2004, he's writing this, but he knows that he needs new people to come see him. maybe for a cash flow. I don't know, but also so he can continue to create.
Yeah, I mean, what strikes me about that is that A, he's analyzing it in that kind of way and saying, right. Okay, you know, I understand why people fall in a trap, but I understand if you work harder, you shouldn't.
Right.
And I've got to have a relationship with these people during the show. Mm-hmm. You know, so him realizing that those guys over there are just staring, but that's not who I'm interacting with right now is pretty interesting. It also, to some degree, tells the story of why, right, the other 60s, 70s bands that became, you know, greatest hits artists or oldies
legacy acts
became that.
Yeah.
Right. Because they just said, okay, this is the relationship now. I'm going to pantomime my stuff. You're going to clap and cheer and we're going to go home. And Bob was saying, I don't want to play that game for me, for himself. He didn't want to do that. But once again, you know, as always, get those quotes, you know, a lot of times you think he's saying stuff that's kind of, you know, throwing up weird shit to sound weird. And then at some point you go, oh, that's dead right, smart.
It's incredibly profound.
Deeply thought through.
Right.
Stuff. The other thing I want to say, even when, again, re-listening with this different eye on these things, is even many of these songs that are battered by bands, there's always a line or two that no one else. I was listening to Emotionally Yours today, and I'm not going to be able to quote it, but there's a couple of phrasings in there for a simple I love you song.
Right.
That no one else could have and did write that version. You know, if that's being trite, at least he's damn, you know, compelling and interesting and being trite.
You know, and to talk about specific lines in my notes, I had where he does go back to, you know, not roots music, but to something that he had done in his career. And we see obviously more of is the film noir quotes that he pulls or the lines that inspire him. And I just found it. I mean, Oliver Traeger tells us that Empire Burlesque is the name of a theater in Newark, New Jersey, probably next door to the YMCA where he got that flannel from your comment on Twitter. But it's, to me, it's interesting because of what film noir is and the functions of it. And I kind of robbed from my, you know, my lecture on film noir because I'm teaching lit and film right now. But it's, to me, and I've got to find the notes. So film noir basically deals with an aging protagonist who's an anti-hero, and he's dealing with the corruption of the world. And so the lyric composition, he's going back to that well a bit, and he's really using it. There's no other time in his career that he uses it this much as he does on Knocked Out Loaded and Empire Burlesque. And so it's signified by the anti-hero, world weary, aging, and not classically handsome. And I laughed because I thought that kind of made me think of Dylan. It's led by post-war disillusion. Obviously, it's World War I first and then World War II disillusion, but we can look at it as maybe post-Vietnam War. I don't know if it's a stretch. But, you know, he is like the themes that he's communicating on these albums about, you know, love, struggles, challenges, suffering of human existence, they're all there. And so just it kind of fits. And he goes back there and kind of uses those things that he finds interesting rather than roots music. He's using film noir. Maybe he is world weary and aging. He's aging. And I don't know. He could be classically handsome, perhaps. But I think that he is sort of that film noir. He's playing with it a little bit more to kind of signal, perhaps, where he is in his life in those, you know, in his creative space in that moment. And it feels safe. And maybe because those lyrics, those lines are overly simple, his lyrics feel overly simple, but there's still some sense of connection and there's some profundity there.
Let's wrap up by talking about what you think came out of the 80s. And so he went through the period of struggle.
Right.
He tried things, he learned things, he discarded things. You know, the time out of mind period, and you know, we know the whole arc, but the last third, you know, the big mountain from time out of mind on feels very different. But I know you've thought about this. Is there anything that you think that he got out of this that helped him find his way out and find his way to a new peak?
I wonder if it's the wisdom of age, you know, that he that line in Silvio and I don't know if he wrote it or Robert Hunter did, but let the echo decide if I was right or wrong. And the echo seems like it's coming outward towards him. Like he said something and now there's something coming back. And what's coming back in the 80s is not necessarily positive. And I think he, not that he's ever really tried to please anyone, but he's trying to figure out if what he's doing is hitting with folks. I think he stops caring. And I think he, you know, maybe he gets past that middle age hump that we all kind of go through. Maybe I'm going through it now, but he gets past it. And I think that he finds the sense, you know, it's, he is creating from roots music. He's doing what he wants to do. And I think that that he had to get past that because I don't know that Time Out of Mind sounds like anything that else that's being released in 1997. And clearly, you know, all the albums that come in the 21st century really don't. And so I think he's creating what he wants to create. And he, not only did he find that connection to his breath, to his creativity, you know, whether it happened miraculously, all of a sudden he's hit by a lightning bolt, as he says in interviews and in chronicles, that it makes it sound like some sort of miracle has happened from God, which is lovely, but you know, maybe that's how it felt to him. But I think that's the moment. And he said, I'm going to recommit, but he just figures out how he can do something, you know, how he can create again. And he says in Chronicles that it was so elemental that he'd forgotten about it. And he said, like, I've forgotten how to put on my pants. And so somehow he lost touch in that period with who he was as an artist, and he found his way back to it. And that's the gift that he's given us. He's very generous as an artist. You know, he gives us, even in the 80s when it's not great, but he gives us wonderful art to talk about. And these gifts that we have kind of are fulfilling and sustaining for us. And maybe that's my Dylan, but I think that's what he figures out. It's just like, he doesn't give a shit, you know, like he's not going to try to fit with whatever, you know, whatever mold that Dylan is. And he did teach us to defy expectations, but I think he gives a shit less now than he did in 1984. I don't know. Maybe that's it. And he, you know, he's kind of figured out his own formula, maybe. I mean, it's not formulaic, but how he likes to create. That's what I think. You're kind of smiling. What's that?
No, I think it's great. And well, first of all, it's his fifth way of not giving a shit in his,
yeah.
Right. He's famous for not giving a shit from the right. beginning, but it clearly makes sense. The idea that, you know, in any, you know, anyone that you've got to struggle. And a lot of the story of Dylan is of, you know, what's Bias's line, you know, but emerging as a star from.
Right.
All I'm saying is that Dylan, you know, he was a superstar from the moment he walked on the scene.
Right.
And he had 20 years or, you know, 15 years almost of adulation.
Unassailable adulation.
As much as anything else. As much as anything else, going through the 80s and getting, you know, having to live with the kind of, you know, you've quoted a lot of great things he said, which are not a guy, you know, who every, you know, changed the culture, as Michael Gray mm-hmm. says, or, you know, went right. through those first really 35 years of his life. So to live through that, you know, it's like, it's a movie, right? It's okay. We mm-hmm. need this down period for something new to get built right. on. And I think your explanation that what he took out of that is a new form of self-confidence or a new right. form of, you know, a new base to go build on. And, you know, the actual building, if you look, you know, if you try to chronicle it, right, we're talking about the mid 80s and it's still a decade before that happened. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the net started in 88 and pieces started getting put in place. I always look at the whole thing as what's admirable is the fortitude of it all, right? Is to have been that high, get that kind of exaggerated low. I mean, it's not, you know, a low by a lot of standards, but for Bob Dylan, it's a low. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in the middle of it, he's still getting the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction. You know, big things are happening.
Songwriters Hall
out.
Of Fame. Yeah.
Right. All these things are happening, you know, which is, you know, a dichotomy, right? He's feeling bad. And yet these people are in some degrees worse, telling him how great he is while his contemporary work is being.
Those are end of career awards that the culture is telling him, like, you're the, you know, like they're telling him these are end of career awards. And he is, you're right, pushing through. There's a sense of fortitude there. That
yeah. And to do all that and to you know, the struggle, which this period will officially be named now. and then say, okay, the way the net happened, right.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's amazing to say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And,
right.
and to know it, not just, I'm just going to go play because I like to play, but I need to go back so much that they get sick of me and new people come. Right. And I need to go to the weird little places, not to Madison Square Garden, because I want them to stop thinking of me as that guy and start thinking of me as this guy.
Right.
And then do it by, you know, hauling your ass to 140 or 60 or 80 shows a year, year after year after year. Mm-hmm. That's an unbelievable commitment while finding his way back to the songwriting, while saying, okay, so now I'm 50. I'm going to stop, you know, wearing the shirt I wear on the cover of Empire Burlesque, which may be the other low point.
But come on, it's so good. Like, you look at that and you know exactly what year or time frame that's in.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Wesley Stace on one of these shows with me said, I thought it was clever the way he put it. He goes, even the artist may regret that cover.
But I think to have failed and to failed consistently for that period, and, you know, in the albums, and there are good things like Letterman, but also Hearts of Fire fails. And it's just like, there's just so much failure that maybe the pressure is off. And like he says, like, he's not trying to be top dog anymore. He's not trying to move the culture along. So there's got to be a sense of liberation in that. From like every Rolling Stone article is like, when a new album comes out, they're like, Bob Dylan is back. And they're like, they want so badly to create that narrative, but it just doesn't hold because there are other folks saying, not really, you know, and Grail Marcus is one of the folks who's saying, there, here are the good bits, but, you know, he's a little bit more honest about what Dylan is doing, and he will give accolades where they belong, but he's not, as I said to you, it seems almost like in some of those Rolling Stone reviews, maybe directed by Jan Wenner, who knows, but, they're almost like his PR people. Dylan is back and this is the greatest thing, but then it doesn't really bear out. But he's failed consistently, and so he's liberated, and like, maybe that's the fifth wave of not giving a shit.
Yeah. There's a shock, there's a denial, there's accept, you know, maybe it goes through all the stages there.
Which is a grief,
and then
yeah.
It's the end is okay, I'm gonna take it as a challenge to improve, which he clearly does.
Right.
You know, and find a new way. And then to accept it and be comfortable with the one and decide what he wants to do. He also then does, incidentally, at the end of this, he goes back to the blues again, right, before the Time Out of Mind period. But it's all, you know, whatever, we can say it a million ways. The point is, it's on top of this, and this allowed it to happen. You know, it would have been more surprising if there was, you know, 60s Dylan, Blood on the Tracks Dylan, Born Again's always going to be weird, but, and then, if this mid-low was replaced with a peak before Time Out of Mind, that would have even been stranger. We needed this in the story. He just did it for us, so we had an arc.
It needed to be down. And yeah,
he planned it. Yeah. So,
it reminds me of what I think John Lennon said about Elvis, that when they met Elvis, they realized that Elvis was one guy, and he had to navigate that fame and adulation as one person, and they at least had each other. And Dylan is doing the same thing. He's just one guy who had to deal with the same thing, and it's got to be maddening. There's a whole section in the Paul Williams, the middle period book, where some guy, a BBC documentarian, is following Bob Dylan and saying that he's Bob Dylan's relative. And it's just like, that's got to be alarming to you, you know, to someone who, like, a singular subjective human being, to have someone following you and wanting to have access to you so badly that they're willing to fake being a family member and have documentation.
I repeat this all the time because it's my favorite thing. There's Lynn Goldsmith quote from the mid 70s where she got to spend time with Bob, obviously, and said, you can't imagine what it must be like to have someone every minute either telling you or asking you if you're God.
Right.
I mean, we all know what it's like to maybe be in some situation where you go in the room and you're sort of the center of attention for a minute. Mm-hmm. Now imagine that magnified by 10 million and every second of your life. And then think about being inside that guy. It's mind boggling what the guy's gone through. And that, you know, people talk about him being weird. It's shocking how normal he is. And all the stories we get where he's found a way, somewhat by treating Bob Dylan as a character, somewhere by, you know, being weird on purpose, somewhere by
just saying, I'm going to go walk around and I'm going to go to this guy's house and talk to him, even though he doesn't know who I am, and maintain that relationship for 20 years. Mm-hmm. He's created devices, you know, strategically right. to allow that to happen. It's vastly under-discussed and reported, maybe to the good. You know, it's kind of his business. But right. to, for the fans to acknowledge at least what he has to go through at that level, or what he has gone through, and say, okay, well, maybe, you know, I don't need to ask him for another fucking autograph or like any of that.
If stuff. You needed it, he'd give it to you.
That's the best quote ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. The kid that I was sitting next to the first night in Chicago, it was his 23rd birthday. And all he wanted to do for his 23rd birthday was to see Bob Dylan. And I was encouraged because I was encouraged at the diversity in age and, you know, and also racial demographics of the concerts in Chicago. But he was like, don't you want to meet him? And I was like, no. And he said, I want to ask him all these questions. I was like, he's not going to answer you. And if he does, it's all going to be bullshit. And it was just so, he's so exuberant and so new to the conversation that he was just like, he's like, I want to ask him about this. And I'm like, he's not going to tell you. Like, he won't. But the moment I thought was so sweet when Dylan was playing Every Grain of Sand, because I was on the aisle and he was next to me. He said, I want to go down there. I was like, go, because people were kind of going towards the stage. And he just stood there rapt while Bob was singing. And it was just such a beautiful moment for this 23-year-old that all he wanted to do on his birthday was to see Bob Dylan. And then he came back. He's like, I really need to talk to him. I was like, you don't need to talk to him. Like, you don't. But
did you tell him that you could introduce him to many, many people that would talk to him for any number of hours? It wouldn't be Bob, but there are plenty of places to go talk. I always say Bob gave it the office, like,
yeah,
you know, let him rest.
But, right. I did. Cause when I sat down, he said, are you here alone? I said, well, I'm sitting alone, but, and I was pointing out all the different like Dylan scholars and critics who were in the audience. Cause you could still see them standing up, and Michael Glover Smith is so tall that you could see him in the fourth row. And he was like, he's like, you guys write about Bob Dylan. I was like, that's pretty much all we want to do. We talk about Dylan. We write about Dylan. It's like, if you want to come tomorrow night to the meetup, please do. And I was like, he was just so enamored of it. And then he follows me on Twitter now, and he DM'd me like, how was the second show? I was like, he's so excited. I was like, you should have come. He played Truckin', man. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, now I do think it's interesting now to this idea of personal Dylans that there's 10 more, meaning there's TikTok Dylan, and mm-hmm. there's all these, you know, like some of the younger people on Twitter, like who have this whole other weird, to me, you know, orientation to him. And it's great. And, you know, because it still finds him into the music, and, you know, so many sides he's round. What can we do?
Yeah. And Dylan fan fiction is a thing that Rebecca Slayman told me about.
Oh, God.
I know. I haven't. I'm interested in it, but not so much that I've read any yet. But I think that I need to know more about that. Dylan fan fiction.
Somebody needs to write the version where, you know, where the what happened after Down in the Groove was, you know, the opposite turn, just kept going.
Instead kept of going back. Down into the groove.
Yeah. The Dylan that wound up working at a 7-Eleven in, you know, Arizona somewhere in the late 90s, because the fortune was gone and the fame was gone. And anyway.
That's tragic.
All right, Aaron, I think we've definitively proved that everyone is wrong and the 80s are great. And no one will ever speak ill of it again.
They will. And, you know, I'm never confident enough to say I'm right or definitive about anything with Dylan, but this is how I'd like to look at the 80s, that, you know, it's a bridge between all of the other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's a bridge, and it's interesting, and it's great. It doesn't have to be as great as
everything else.
As like a Rolling Stone.
Right.
Anyway. Thank you very much. We will all look forward to your book. We will form little groups, and, you know, five at a time, we'll buy the first book and then share it. So we'll, and now it's a $20 book. Fine. No one needs the book on their shelf for years. You just need the book for a month and then.
No.
Thanks for listening. This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.